Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we have a really interesting show. I like shows that deal with time. And tonight's show is going to be Time in the Lord's Name, which I've done shows related to this. I thought that I would go much deeper into the time element of how that relates to the name of God and what that means in terms of us and what time in general is and how it controls or is controlled by the thoughts and then ultimately behaviors of the life that God chooses to create in the beginning, and that we are co-creators in from that point forward. So it is it's going to be a really interesting show. I hope that you like this. It's going to have some physics in it, but I'll try to make that as easy as I can, considering that for some people, that's not always the easiest thing. And let me start off by first defining for you what I mean by the word time, because that's in the title. Time in the Lord's Name is the title. And time is a measure. It's a measure, but not a measure of what a lot of people think, like, oh, it measures, you know, how long something is, whatever that means. Time is actually a measure of the quality of activity. So if an activity that someone or something is doing, it either uses up time, which means it separates time from space, it uses up time, or it uses little or no time. If it uses no time to take some activity, then the activity becomes what is called, in spiritual terms, in metaphysical terms, intelligent activity. And intelligent activity means that it's so intelligent, it communicates so well with all other energy, the energy that's moving, changing, doing whatever it's doing, does it in such a perfect way that it separates no time from space. And we would say in our perception of that effect that, gee, that didn't take any time at all. Literally, no time was taken to use any kind of energy in some activity. Now, energy also means form, matter, in our terminology. And forms and matter, if you're physically alive, that's us, but form can be things other than matter, but it's like, it has substance to it. If it has substance to it, then the substance took no time in which to carry out an activity, and then that activity would be fully intelligent. Oh, wow. And so time is a measure of this. And you can say, well, what does that mean? Okay. Well, what it means is this. When something doesn't separate time from space, because time and space are really part of the same thing. Time is an element, a part of what we call space. When it doesn't take any time, that means that the relationship between the form of one thing and the form of another, or energy of one thing and energy of another thing, as it's connected to an event. In other words, they share an event together. Oh, what's an event? Well, an event is just a shared activity in time and space. The shared event is communicated so extremely perfectly, and there's so much extreme perfection where it is absolutely perfect in terms of the planning, in terms of the interactions, in terms of the giving, and in terms of the ability for each to be co-creating. So their freedom, they have freedom and liberties. All that is taking place at the same moment between the same beings who are doing this, let's say, if it were beings doing this, then we would have, at that particular junction, perfected consciousness. Perfected consciousness. Consciousness would even, we would say, grow by the two or more interacting entities, energies, whatever we want to talk about. And theoretically, it doesn't even have to be something alive. It could even be a couple of electrons that are doing this, but that's another thing. And this perfection then produces light. It produces an enlightened state. The enlightened state means that both are being more creative, they're being more capable of being creators at the same time that they're being more conscious, and their consciousness is growing in the process. At the same time, their activity is becoming perfected so that no energy is expended. It's an effortless activity in a sense, and it's perfect because the intelligence is so perfected between whatever we're talking about, to electrons, to people, to godlike beings. It doesn't matter. That's the neat thing about time. It's a measure of the perfection or lack thereof of all the things I just said. Wow. And every time it takes place at or near that level of perfection, consciousness is growing, life is growing, God is growing, good things are happening. It's a neat thing. Now, how do we know when this is taking place? Well, in our terminology, we usually say that you can see that virtue has been created. Virtue means that there is light represented in some form way. We can see that the form itself is becoming enlightened because what is happening? The form is freer. The form is more creative. That's like the first part of God's mind. The form is more loving. It's more inclusive. It's more conscious. That's the second part of God's mind. And the form is more intelligent. The form has greater levels of perfection in its activity and actions. There is no time spent at all in the co-interactions. And a kind of fourth way we can tell is that there is beauty. Anyone experiencing or watching the activities take place, their senses grow. Their senses become further enlightened just by being both observers and hearers or whatever sense they're using of the activity. Pretty cool, huh? Yeah. So that's how we measure the time issue. And what about this business of the Lord's name? Well, this is kind of cool, too. It turns out that the universe was created by frequencies of sound that have a certain pitch to them, a certain angle to the way that they are directed towards life. An angle. And it's actually a number of angles because there's a number of dimensional elements to it. And it is literally by both, we'll say, tradition and by real action, the name of God. And the name of God includes these sounds, which are vibrations. Okay? So they call it sounds in ancient history. And they also have referred to it as a way of being an expression of God, that if any life recreates that expression of vibration, they are working within time that is in the Lord's name. In other words, the time stays joined with space completely, and the Lord's name is being enunciated by the interactions of those beings who so function, because the quality of time is perfected, and then the Lord's name becomes revealed. Okay. And can I give you an example of this? Yes, I can. The Lord's name starts with something that resembles, in seven different dimensional ways, the word Om. Okay, Om. And it ends in seven dimensional ways, but with an emphasis on the most seventh, the lowest vibration of the word om. Okay, I admit, maybe I can go to singing school or something. But the point is, or voice school, the point is that this type of sound, these two sounds, have another five sounds connected with them. And all seven of them, represented in all the different dimensional ways that they have to be expressed, which is a little complicated, okay, is the vibration of the ultimate name of God. And in physics, now I'm going to kind of switch gears on you. Physics, I know some of you say, oh, he's into the physics business. Okay, in physics, in some branches of physics called string theories, okay, there's a bunch of string theories. In Life's Hidden Meaning, I talk about string theory, but I use the general way because, unfortunately, at the time I wrote that book originally in 1993, it was published in 99. When that book was written, there was so little understood about string theory, so much was missing, even membrane string theory or M theory was not really defined at the beginning. That there was so much missing that, unfortunately, I couldn't really go very deep in the subject because nobody would have understood it, and also there's kind of a mystical, we'll call it, or metaphysical rule to not reveal very much of anything about what human knowledge has yet to have discovered. So that's to keep people from borrowing incorrectly and misunderstandingly some bits of knowledge from the metaphysical world that might be used in wrong ways. So, at any rate, getting back to this question then, all right, so what does that mean in string theory? String theory says that there's these little strings that are wrapped up in part of what makes something an atom. Okay, that's the basic idea. All particles inside atoms are actually created. Each particle, subatomic particle, is made by a little string. And the little string vibrates in a certain way, and some of the strings move in one direction, some of them another direction. Some are open strings, some are closed strings, some are strings that are part of membranes, some are strings that attach between membranes, some things, strings have nothing to do with membranes, depending upon what you believe. And a membrane is really the surface of a dimension. And so all of this is happening from these vibrating strings, and there seems to be some truth to this, in at least as far as physics is concerned, but not everybody buys into it. And that's what creates particles, or subatomic particles, and then the subatomic particles create particles, and then the particles become part of atoms. So within the foam, or the probability of an atom being created, there is this propensity for strings to create the atom. And nowadays, they're talking about strings affecting another major particle in field called the Higgs field. And when they vibrate within this Higgs field, they take on some form of matter in the physical world. It's all kind of goofy, but because it's like putting all this between us and God, and it doesn't really explain very much other than it gives them something to test for. And that's the main reason the physicists invent these things, is because they don't have anything else to do unless they can actually test for it, because part of physics is testing for the physical world. Okay. Now, these strings are somewhat real, not exactly what physicists believe them to be, but that doesn't matter. We can use the same idea. But the thing that physicists don't understand very much, although they actually, some physicists have proposed this and even have the number of dimensions somewhat correctly named, is that they believe these are connected to these dimensions. They think the dimensions are very tiny, tiny things, but the dimensions are actually huge things, and that has to do with their misunderstanding of what the string really is doing. But we'll get to that. So the physicists are trying to say that strings could be connected from one dimension to another. And if they are connected, then each higher dimension, meaning there's more dimensionality to the string, is connected to a lower dimensionality string. So it's kind of a strange factor in the way the physicists try to explain it. Now, the reason they say that these dimensions grow smaller and smaller is because they think incorrectly, that the number of strings increases. It increases as you move from one dimension to, quote-unquote, what they call a higher dimension. The actual truth is they decrease. So they have the whole thing inverted. But that's okay. I mean, at least they're getting closer. I mean, I'd rather have them inverted than not have any idea about it at all. And so what they think is, hey, if you have one string here, you have two strings in the next dimension, and three strings in the next dimension, etc. And the reason they believe that is because the way they're defining strings really has to do with an object kind of thing. And really, a string has to do more with the sound of God's name and the complexity of that sound. That's where the vibration comes from. So if you start in the physical dimension, the vibration is actually less complex. It becomes simpler, even though it's the lowest dimension. It becomes simpler because the string is really stifled by a thing we call inertia and density. Gravity itself stifles the string and prevents it from being able to access all of the qualities of God's name. So God's name becomes more and more, we'll say, reduced in its qualities, and it doesn't have the finer elements of all the different vibrations and directions of those vibrations that come from strings that are vibrating and creating particles in higher dimensions of time and space. That being the case, what happens is the dimensions actually cause an increase in the size of the dimensional space, not a decrease. Especially since we're talking about multidimensional space, you've got a lot of different elements to that space now that makes it huge. And these aren't little tiny, 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 tiny dimensions. They're huge, 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 huge dimensions. But there's just a mistake in the way that physicists are trying to understand what those dimensions look like. Okay, I hope I'm not getting too far into the woods here, because I know that most of you are not physicists out there, and the ones of you that are probably say, oh, well, this guy's just a crackpot, and he's just a crazy guy. Well, not if you read Life and Meaning, and not if you call me. I'll be glad to talk to you about this. And if you actually do math, that includes the missing element in almost all physics math, and that is time. And then in addition to time, you also have to have thought. So if you include time and thought and use time the way I suggested as what it is, you have to use it that way. And then you use thought as an important element to the creative process. I'm going to bring that in a few minutes. Then suddenly, I won't look so crazy, and your calculations will start making some sense even to you, if you're a physicist now. This is for them. I thought I'd give them a little bone, throw something out to them right now. Okay, so here is our most interesting part, in that, okay, now we got some ideas about this physics thing, and he's got the vibrating things, and the vibrations really have to do with the name of God, and it's God's name that has really created everything that exists. Wow. I mean, this is pretty cool stuff, and it only has to do with 7 times 7 these things that we call strings, so that's like 49 different kinds of expression of sound. That is, at the same time, has Each one has a different direction to it as well. So figure that out. You got 49 times 7 now. So that's you have to multiply that out, and then you come up with a big number that actually some physicists have figured, come up with that number before. And so you look at this and you say to yourself, wow, that's pretty cool. And then you also have to be careful because the last dimension, the one we're in, the dense physical and the electromagnetic part of it together, or the etheric for people who are familiar with that word, is being counted as 3 dimensions. And a lot of times they count the monastic dimension as an extra one, so that's like 2. You add it all up, they come up with 10 dimensions. And there's really only 7. But they're adding up like, oh, there's 3 dimensions right here, aren't there? Height, width, and depth. Well, actually, there's only really 1 dimension from where we are, but we see 3 because we're so much in illusion, we can't tell that it's really a single dimension. Now, some physicists have agreed that we only have 1 dimension here, but others keep up with this, especially in string theory. They tend to keep up with this idea that there's 10. It's okay. Some of them come up with 11. But it's due to the illusionary aspects of our life right now. Seen from a much higher realm, it would be correctable, but most people aren't looking from that realm, and they're working from physics here. All right. So God's name is garbled here because time is so separated from space that it's virtually unrecognizable. And time is seen as 3 elements, past, present, and future, in illusion, because the whole dimension is separated in height, width, and depth. But really, there's only 1 dimension. Therefore, time only has 1 dimension to it. And that means that there's a thing called a now, where time is happening all at the same time. That's a little strange to understand. But physicists have discovered this to be somewhat true, and they're very confused by it. When they start trying to examine time, what they find is that time can be run backwards or forwards. As a matter of fact, in a thing that we'll call it quantum physics, it doesn't matter whether a particle is going backwards and forwards or forwards in a lot of circumstances. And some particles only go backwards. No kidding. Yeah, there's time particles. There's time particles that only move backwards in time. They don't move forwards in time as far as we can tell. And all these illusions are brought about that there's 3 dimensions and there's 3 parts to time and the whole thing. Because we can't live in what is called the now until we think in perfection at the height of the 2 dimensions above us, the mental world. I mean, you have to be very top. You have to think like the creature, the being, who created the mental world as a part of God's plan. And we would have to be in that form of consciousness to even recognize that. Some human beings have attained that level, but it's rare, where they actually recognize this thing called a now, and it isn't the now that a lot of, we'll say, New Agey writers have talked about. This is the real now that's written about in Life and Meaning, and that can be defined in terms of physics. And so there are some rare humans that actually can think controlled in a way in this thing called a now. It's amazing. And then they usually also have commensurate levels of a thing called buddhic or intuitional, controlled intuitional consciousness. Okay, so, wow. All this because time is messed up. And it's messed up because we're in illusion, and humans are so in illusion that they're splitting. We're the main creator of this problem. Throughout the universe, there's enough humans, not just on Earth, doing this, that are messing up time and producing this odd effect that there is past, present, and future to time. Because time is being split. The past is split from the present, is split from the future. Every event in time has all 3 events, if you go to the highest level, being expressed through God's name, the sound of God, through the complexity of the string that is connecting the particles of the event. Actually, there's more than one string, but the strings that are connecting the particles of more than one event, of one any one event, is producing this completeness to the activity. Now, let me try to put that in more simpler terms so that you can understand what I mean. Okay, you ready? Here it comes. If, let's say that, let's say there's an activity where we, along with several others, decide to create an improvement in life that allows life to better follow the virtuous patterns of others that are creating life more advanced than it is around it. We invent this, okay? And in so doing, we can, from the perspective of being a great being ourselves, say, gee, I can see the past, what the time has done. I can see the present, what we're doing, and I can see what all the outcomes are going to be. All the outcomes are going to be for that. Therefore, you have what is known as a probabilistic anomaly. And the probabilistic anomaly, which has to do with something called the quantum foam, that's all the possibilities for that event, quantum foam, all the possibilities for that event, are now known. We know. Well, at the point where you know all the probabilities for something that's going to take place, as far as you're concerned, as far as we're concerned, we're the great beings doing this, right? It's already happened. Because we know everything that is probable that's going to happen. Now, not everything is possible. Only anything and everything is going to happen that is possible, but not everything is going to happen. Okay, anything and everything is going to that's possible to happen, we know about. And but we don't intervene. If we're at that level, we do not intervene. Because we know that that if we were to intervene in any way, we would be cutting down the freedom of some of the potential for life, to this lower life we're talking about, to do its thing. You know? And we would be acting against God, and then our ability to know would be gone. We would instantly stamp it out. And so we wouldn't know the future. We wouldn't know, even have a clue about it, because we are working against God. And we would eliminate ourselves from such understandings. Okay. So those who understand are never the ones who are also the actors in the situation. Isn't that cool? So if you're omniscient, you could be omniscient about anything as long as it doesn't involve you. If it involves you, your booty or controlled omniscience and controlled intuition, they're all the same, all the different words for the same thing, can never be part of that which involves you, yourself. Because then you would be intervening in your own controlled intuition, and it wouldn't be there anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So only those who lie outside of the interaction can be the ones who actually have the controlled intuition about it, which is a cool thing. And it allows for this freedom, which is so critical, for life to be free to co-create or not so with its own creator, and then you're not bugging up that system, you see. That's a good thing. And so, from, again, trying to visualize an example of this thing that I'm talking about, we can know the past, present, and future of things that are not going to involve us in terms of our interactions with it. And it allows us to then be able to have a future understanding of something, as well as to produce this thing called the now. And the sound of God's name at that level is now represented by what we have helped to co-create ourselves in, but are now not participating with. And it's a really neat thing that we could be so involved and so conscious ourselves with God that we can share in God's perception of some things, provided our own interactions are not directly involved in what is taking place. What a cool thing that is. And so, time, in the Lord's name, can only be heard through the Lord's name when we have joined time and things are taking place in a now, and we are not directly involved in the interactions that are connected to whatever events we are examining, and we have passive participation in. Only passively can we have some kind of interaction. Now, this is a bit different than quantum physics, which says that any perception would cause a change in the quantum foam of possibilities and create a problem. That's not true. There's an exception to that rule, but quantum physicists don't know that at this time because they don't understand the difference between being a non-participating observer and being the participating observer. So they don't quite understand that because they have to understand the element of thought, and they don't have that yet in their equations, and it causes a lot of confusion for some of them. But nonetheless, the cool thing about this is that God has created a universe that is wholly and fully discoverable, one in which we can become a part of God to experience. But as we do, we remove ourselves from being a participant in interaction. So we can't be involved in energy transfers if we're going to function from this position. We can, at different times, be involved in energy transfers, but then we're blocked from being in the perspective of God. Great beings who follow this understanding will shift their viewpoint, so to speak, and sometimes they'll be interacting when they consider that the appropriate mode, and other times they may be the passive and non-interactive observers. So they know the difference and know when to exercise it. Human beings can only learn how to do this, but can't fully operate within it until they transfer their consciousness into the superhuman kingdom. They go back and forth in it. Very advanced human beings can go back and forth in this process, training themselves about it, but they can't completely become a part of it until they have given up certain parts of their ability to participate. The first part has to do with giving it up in the three lower worlds. So they can no longer directly affect, through their interactions, the three lower worlds. They can only help others through teaching and other ways to do so, but they then gain this ability at will to remain in the state of omniscience, which is a great thing. So that's the trade-off for what we call masters of the angels' wisdom. There's a lot of other names for them, of course, including solar angels, who are energy beings, but who are also equal masters. All these we'll call them advanced beings, are part of this process, but they do give up their ability to be incarnated into the system and be part of the interactions of the system in the three lower worlds, which is the mental, astral, and the etheric physical. All they can do in those worlds, once they choose to do this, is to advise, teach, help others in some obscure ways, but not in any direct fashion. They can't come in and do something. The dark ones, the dark masters in particular, are trying to figure out a way around that problem. Good luck to them. No luck to them. I don't give them good luck, but they're never going to do it. You can't do it because it goes against the laws of God and physics, even. And because it's quantum physically impossible, but that's not the end all of everything. And it's impossible in terms of what the metaphysics, even the super metaphysics that I'm talking about tonight, that involve how God's creating and functioning in the universe, goes against those things. They can never achieve the results they're actually attempting to do. Good thing for us, too. Because if they could achieve this, they could literally destroy the universe and destroy God, as we understand it. But the whole thing's set up so they can't do it. So don't worry about that. It's not going to happen. I know it seems like, whoa, well, you never know about those dudes. But this is one of those cases where the dice are loaded. There's no way around it. So don't worry about it. Okay. So time now has different ways of expressing itself. When in illusion and when people are acting selfishly, time has the elements of at least past, present, and future. There's even, you can even divide those up further. You can even split those more if a culture gets a lot of selfishness or if individuals have a lot of selfishness to them to make it, you know, the distant past, the recent past, kind of the present, but even different ways of seeing the present. And in the very distant future and the near future, I mean, you can have a kind of crazy kind of split in time. Most people don't do that, but some earlier cultures actually have had those kinds of time expressed. There's also the cyclical nature to time. Now, the reason time seems cyclical is that when you reach a point of enlightenment, you start to realize that all three parts of time are happening at the same time, and that does seem relatively circular and has a cyclical nature to itself. But the only reason for that is you're misunderstanding it, not because you truly do understand it. But still, there is this cyclical nature caused to the semi-illusions in understanding now. And it has value to realize that some people do experience that, even cultures have, and have incorporated that kind of time within their culture, all coming from the same basic semi-true premise about time. Okay, so, really neat. Now we have some understanding of time. We have some understanding of what I mean by time in the Lord's name. I'm going to start expanding upon this in models of behaviors and how this all applies to us in the physical realm and then in the astral when we go on, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about the mental world. Because all these are human experiences. How does this really make a difference to us? How it is, I'm going to define time even more for those of you who are very interested in time, so don't get off the line. And by the way, if we lose you, because they're working on the lines over at the radio station 1,000 miles from here, don't get concerned. Call back, because they're going to quickly fix it, I've been told. They're doing some testing which may cause us to lose each other for a short time, but we'll get on it right away and try to restore that so that we can all work and function together. Okay, we're going to be back, give or take a little, in about 2 minutes and 30 seconds or so from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower, M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And I hope that break is gave you a little time to cool off your brain. Because there was a lot to cover in that first section, which had all these definitions in it. And yeah, I understand this is not easy stuff. But as we work through the rest of the show, some of what I said at the beginning will start to make a little more sense. We're kind of going to apply it in practical situations more. And I think it'll kind of fit. Okay. So what does this all mean? Let's say that you want to live a more spiritual life. You want to live a life that's more part of God, you know. And maybe you're spiritually disciplining yourself. Maybe you're considering that. Or maybe you're saying, well, that's going to be my next life. And I'll get to that when I get to the astral world or whatever. But if any of those might fall into what you're thinking, here's some important little tips, we'll say, that are helpful. Once you understand at least enough of tonight's show, you can perform little shortcuts in terms of realizing or understanding if you are on the right track as far as creating light, creating virtue and form, and light and form, which is virtue, and doing virtuous things in your life. And that's because each time that you are doing so, although it's really watered down when you're physically alive, because remember, this vibration becomes very complicated and much stronger as we move into higher dimensions of time and space. I'm going to talk about that later in the show, but for right now, we'll just talk about the physical world. There is a very subtle but strong enough to perceive for a person who has worked on their senses and improved them and has made an effort to live their life in a virtuous way, there's a direct sense a person has of the vibration which is in God's name, which is inside of us. So we can directly feel, I know that sounds hard, in a physical sense. I'm not talking about feelings like astral, although I'm going to get to those later. But we can directly feel, in a physical sense, this vibration of God's name when we're creating virtue in ways that is in accord with God. Yeah. Now you're going to say, well, wait a second. Are you talking about some kind of hippie-ish drug addict, druggers? Sensation like, hey man, I can feel the Lord, you know, or somebody who may be very religious and had some kind of epiphany you know, kind of experience or some kind of altered state experience from either a heavily religious thing or whatever. Or all of the above, who knows? Someone who's doing all kinds of unusual stuff. No. Okay. I'm not talking about most of those experiences that people claim they're having, because those kinds of experiences have to deal more with an outside stimulant working upon either the physical nervous system or the astral nervous system or the etheric part of the physical nervous system called the natus system. All of those things involve altering certain kinds of energies in our body in general, but doesn't involve the two centers I'm going to be talking about. The two centers I'm referring to are very specific and have a very specific sensation to them, especially when used together, and they are the heart chakra, when fully open and spinning. It's a little complicated, I'm going to explain that. And combined with the crown chakra, some people call it the head chakra, also fully open and to some extent spinning. Now, what do I mean by spinning? Well, to open a chakra, we have to use it a certain percentage of the time, and it has to be balanced with some of the other chakras it's connected to. They're all connected together in some way. There's seven of those. And there has to be so many of the minor chakras, which don't have any consciousness connected to them, where we use them subconsciously, that's with it, as a sense, with our various senses. It has to have a majority of those minor centers being used. And then that will produce this effect that I'm describing to you, going to describe to you, that allows us to sense God. And to know directly when we're creating, co-creating with God, and when we're not co-creating with God. Okay? With me so far? I hope so. All right. So we have this built-in mechanism, we'll call it, but most people are unaware of it. Now, there have been some yogas in the past that have attempted to develop this sense, but usually for the sake of developing the sense rather than for the sake of service. If you do it that way, including Kundalini yoga, you are creating great harm to yourself and possibly going to drive yourself crazy and possibly will, because you're functioning with your mental body and your mind in bad ways in the body, and it could cause some great harm to you. Some really severe psychological conditions can be produced. And it is dark because you're doing it for self improving purposes. So you can say to yourself and others, "Do look at me. I'm really hot, man. I can sense the sense that I can sense." And you're deluding yourself into believing it's a sense of your creator, when it's really a sense of expanding your ego and self, lower self, rather than expanding God in others. Okay, so the first thing about this has to do with not sensing yourself. Okay. If you're doing any kind of yoga or anything, or you're doing exercises just to try to sense yourself, change the way you feel and sense something about yourself, wrong, isn't going to work. And you're going to say, well, what about those two centers in the senses? It's about sensing others and how well the service you are doing, whatever it is, co-service in whatever way with others, is helping them to sense better, helping them to experience God's name in themselves. And then you pick up joy and eventually bliss from this experience of your service to others. That's how you know. And then that feeling, and I'm going to describe it to you in a minute, that feeling is the feeling that you get in your heart and crown chakras that allows you to hear, sense in every one of your senses, not just hearing, the name of God. You're directly sensing, in a physics sense, the superstring that is connected interdimensionally all the way to the back to the highest level of God, but it usually only goes as far as your consciousness has grown, which is not going to get all the way back to God, but it's going to be kind of God-like. Okay? It's going to go maybe to the intuitional realm, the higher mental realm, very high still, but not all the way to the Atmic plane where God is and all this stuff. No, not going to get that far because humans can't get there. Your consciousness would be so great to get there, you would have to be beyond human. So I'm assuming that those that I'm explaining this to tonight are human beings, because those beyond human already know everything I'm talking about. They've already experienced it, and they'd be yawning and probably saying, hey, I got to do something else with my time to listen to this guy. So this is just for us, right? You know, human beings. Okay. So this is the way that you get there, you see, eventually. But for right now, it's only going to happen when you're serving others. Can't do it because, gee, I want to have a quick experience. Can you slip me some of that LSD, please? No. Or the mushrooms, those mushrooms over there, can you give me those? No. Or how about some of that pot? You know, the really good stuff that they're growing these days over in Blankley. No, that ain't going to work. None of that stuff's good. All that's going to do is the opposite effect. Because it's about you, then. It's what you want to feel like. Okay. So what is this feeling that I'm talking about? What is this sense? You're going to sense it with all your senses. It isn't just any one sense, but it's going to be God's name. It's going to be the Lord's name. We're going to experience the Lord's name. Well, you experience the Lord's name in what some people refer to as the joy of service, which eventually becomes a state of bliss. I'll start with the joy of service so that we can build up to the state of bliss so we all can understand exactly what it is I'm trying to talk about, right? And it comes through the heart and crown chakra together, which then unifies all the other chakras. So don't worry about them. They're going to get kind of filled in there. And the minimum requirement is you have to use 50% plus, which I call it 60%, of the minor centers, of which there's about 370 of them in your body, connected to these seven chakras, and in a balanced way. You have to balance those out. This is not so easy to do, believe me. And the sense that you get while you're serving with, for, and in conjunction with others and God is a sense of what I'm going to call joy. I'm going to define it further because some people who may have never experienced this and others that have don't really understand it. And the sense of joy is a sense of complete fearlessness, no fear, okay, a sense of a lack of bad will towards anyone or anything. What is bad will? It's where you want to reduce the choices of others for whatever reason there is, including they're no good son of a guns and they deserve to have those choices taken away from. That's got to be gone. Can't have any of that. No bad will. You can't have love which does not help others to become equal to or more, usually the or more is the appropriate way, loving than you are yourself. Whoa, that's a tough thing. So your giving has to help others to become equal to or greater than the amount of giving that you are doing, or you won't have this sense of joy that I'm talking about. Okay? Following all that? You can write this down later if you want. You can come back and listen to the show in a day or two when they get it up there. And or a week from now, we'll have it up on our website. And you can listen to it. And you can enumerate this so you understand what I'm talking about. I know, there's a lot of parts to this thing. Okay. So, and then if the joy, now the joy may only last for a few seconds in the beginning of this process for some people because it's so darn complicated. I mean, it's not like, oh, gee, I can do that. It's not that easy to do because you cannot also have any thought about yourself in the process. Your focus or of attention in all your sense is about those you're serving, about life in general, and about God in general, not about yourself. You kind of disappear from the process. But you aren't becoming selfless. What's happening is your self is becoming so much greater by experiencing the selves of all those that are being affected. If you're doing this on a worldwide scale, it's a big, big change. And your self is growing to the worldwide level of all selves that are experiencing this improvement in their relationship with their Creator. Okay, so what about then all of the folks that you're also co-serving with? What are they doing? Okay, because if this is really about them, then what's going on with them? Well, eventually, in this process, through these same centers and other ones, all seven of your chakras, you will experience love coming back to you from all the love that you are creating with everybody else. It isn't coming back directly in most circumstances. It is coming back through a whole set of circumstances that connects back to you. Now, remember this thing about time. When you're in this process that I'm talking about, you're starting to join time together. So an event or a series of events are starting to take place to you in the now. Okay? You're figuring that? You can see that that might happen, right? So if I'm doing this for a whole bunch of, I'm serving with a whole bunch of people using my crown and my heart chakra and the other chakras in balance, and I'm balancing out my minor centers, looks at least to the 60% level or better. This whole thing is really humming, you know, and I'm starting to feel the vibration of God's name and can hear it and can see it, the whole thing. All my senses are being filled with God's name. At that point, I'm experiencing a now. That means that although all of this might not come back to me in a more, we'll call it mundane way, for years of time, because I live in the now, I experience it now. Because I experience the realm of the quantum foam of possibilities all taking place and working their way out, and I already experience the future. I'm living in that now, and so if I can maintain it to that level, I now have entered the area of called bliss. What is the difference between the bliss and the joy? The joy cannot take the product of all of the creation that I've done and experience the now in its fullest sense. I can experience the now only for the individuals where they are in the present, but I can't experience them in the full now all the way into the future, which would be years or even lifetimes away from where my present position is. If I can go into the now for at least my present lifetime, and at least the lifetime in the physical world that I'm in, if that's where I'm living, to the end of that life, I will experience the first part of bliss. And now I'm in bliss rather than in joy. You're following me? I hope. I know this. Some of you are probably saying, wow, this must be the most difficult show he's ever talked about. You know, time is not an easy subject because we are so unfamiliar with what it really is. It's not that it's so difficult, in my opinion, but it's because it's so foreign to us in terms of experiencing time without illusion. So I'm trying to talk about what time is like without the illusion, and most people don't even know what that is. So it's difficult. from that standpoint to put your finger on what I'm saying, because you could say, yeah, I kind of got what he's saying, but I can't, you know, it's hard to relate to it. I understand. And for some of you, this will all be theoretical. And I can't guarantee any of you out there are going to say, yeah, I got that. I know what he's talking about. Because it may be some point in the future that you will experience this from now. I don't know. But I'm teaching it so that you can have a better understanding of it, even if it isn't a complete understanding because you can't experience it yet. Because we can understand some things we haven't experienced, of course. Maybe not as fully as though we might if we were experiencing it. But sense is a wonderful thing, but sometimes we are senseless to what we're trying to understand, and the only thing we can do is just do our best. Physicists almost always are working in realms in which part of what they are trying to understand they have no sense of. So this might even be easier for some physicists to understand, although there might be other problems they're going to have with it. Okay, so this is the fascinating thing about it, is that this joy eventually can become the state of bliss. And it could be, both of them are definable. They're just hard to fully understand because of the experience side of the situation. And I know, for a lot of people, it's just like, holy macaroni, how in the heck is that ever going to be realized? Well, you will. The thing that I can almost guarantee you is at some point, in the future, this will all be experienced. Will it be in this lifetime? Yeah, I can't. You know, that part, if I knew each one of you and had close contact, maybe I could help you out with that part too. I'm not sure. But nonetheless, it's something to think about. At any rate, I did want to mention, we had some problems with the vehicle and people that don't like us very much. I call them evil ones. You know who they are. Some of you know. Came and smashed the car. And, one of the people that I, in a spiritual group with, owns. Yeah, we have things like that go on. It's a terrible thing. And we, again, used Bodyline Automotive Refinishing, George and Shannon Fernandez, over in Apache Junction. To they're working on the car. We appreciate them because they do really good work. And you might want to consider some of their services. Most of what we're talking about was actually covered by insurance, so I'm not doing this, we'll call it a commercial, because there's any kind quid pro quo. As a matter of fact, I don't do any commercials. Haven't done any quid quo pro, meaning that we're getting something in return for it. I do it because they do a good job. And I've talked about them before because they're working on it again. I thought I'd bring their name up tonight. You can go to www.bodylineautofinish. It's a pretty long, crazy name. Website, bodylineautofinish, all one word, .com. And to them, honesty matters more than success, which is a good thing because that's one of the reasons we deal with them. It's very far away, relatively, to where we are. We're in Tempe. They're in Apache Junction. They're in the Far East Side. It's not that far. I mean, it's like about 30 minutes from us. It's worth it to go there, but even if you lived on the far west side of town, I'd recommend them to you. If you're in the Phoenix area, actually, if you're anywhere in this part of the state of Arizona, it's a good thing to take a car to them because they do a great job. And I would recommend them. Their phone number, if you're interested, is 480-234-6366, George and Shannon Fernandez. George has been doing that sort of work for something like 20 years, getting into that realm. He's been working on since he's been 16 years old. And, you know, it's something when someone really devotes themselves to their, in an artistic way, to their job and tries to do things correctly and takes the care to do it right. I know he does. He does a really wonderful job. And he's a great guy and honest, you know. Tries to do things at a fair price and do things always at a high quality. So if you need anything dealing with auto body stuff, painting, got to paint the old car, I recommend going to him compared to one of these cheapo places. You might save $200 or $300, literally, to go to the cheapest place. But the difference, say on a paint job, but the difference of the paint job is going to be like $2,000 or $3,000 worth of difference in terms of the quality. So that's, you know, if you consider the value there, you're getting way more value for your money. And so I always suggest going and giving George a try. And the two of them work together in the business, which is nice. They've got children, et cetera. And so, and if you do go there, just mention that, you know, Niles mentioned them on the radio, and that you went there because I thought it would be worthwhile for you to try. And for those of you who don't have, if you don't have the ability to go there because you live too far away, you might even be in another country, I could just tell you from experience that it's well worth it to find somebody like George and Shannon, because the value you get back in terms of the quality of their services, and this doesn't have to be just about cars, is so much greater. And you're building the virtue in others to continue to do good work, good deeds. And then you're going to participate more in what I have already referred to as the joy of living in a partial now, right now, so to speak, and the joy of co-serving with God and helping others to do the same. So this is one of the things to consider in any of the interactions that we choose to pursue, is to try to be of service to others so that they can continue to function in the light. And one of the ways people function in the light is to do beautiful work. Beautiful work really makes a difference. You want things to be beautiful in your activities. And that brings us back to time. Most people think that it takes a lot of time to create beauty and to work co-creatively with God. This is going to sound strange, but it actually takes less and less time as you get better and better at co-creating with God because, of, as you know, time is caused by mistakes, not by doing things in a virtuous way. It's because we're an illusion, we don't use our senses properly, we use them selfishly. We enter too much into the picture, and then we make terrible mistakes or some mistakes, and that burns up time. And then it seems like it takes a long time to get things right. But the person who's the true artist, the true genius in creating beauty, takes no time to do whatever they're doing. Now, they also may not be human anymore, but nonetheless, I want you to realize that the perception that things that are beautiful, things that are wonderful, take huge amounts of time is not a correct statement. It's a statement for those living in the illusionary part of the universe, right where we are right now. And as we grow, as we develop ourselves, that can reverse itself. And less time is taken to do more and more great virtues. They're co-creative with God. And therefore, we can affect larger and larger amounts of life. More and more people, as an example, can be affected at the same time, growing our joy and eventually producing even further levels of bliss. Because numbers do affect it. If you do it with one person every week, compared to 1 million people every hour, big difference in the outcomes in terms of that joy factor. Remember, you can't do this because you want to have joy or because you want to reach a state of bliss. You do it because you want to serve. You want to co-create with God. Only with that motive will it ever work, as I explained earlier. Otherwise, you're just deluding yourself and you're going the wrong direction. That goes true, especially if you join some religion or some yoga or some other process that is really just focused on yourself and your own experiences. That's a bunch of nonsense. I talk with many people who erroneously, and I listen and usually don't tell them so, but who erroneously tell me about how their experiences changed themselves, what their experience is all about. So about a year ago, a guy sent me a book he wrote, a couple of copies, about all of his experiences at some gathering in the eastern part of the United States, that it was all about his experiences and what he felt this and he felt that and he had this effect. It was about himself. It was the opposite of virtue and the opposite of creation of light. And so little of it was really about others. I mean, it was a little piece here and there, but the point is that this is the antithesis of what I'm discussing. And what I and others, as part of a spiritual group, are attempting to do. So a really, really important point to get into. I want to briefly touch on evil, because I mentioned in this ad for George and Shannon, that someone had smashed a vehicle. Yeah, it's important to recognize, we know who did it, by the way. But that's not the point. They wanted us to know who did it. You know, evil is a very strange thing. It reverses most of the tenets and principles that I teach on this show about God. Very rarely is it truly creative. Only the dark masters are creative in it. Or somebody that's being possessed and controlled by a dark master, maybe. And when we talk about evil, there's no joy for either the evil ones or for us who have to deal, we who have to deal, I should say, with the evil. Because it's a terrible circumstance. You know, we are stuck in the problem. And when somebody does it to us, although we choose then to do something else, it is a issue of really how best to prevent the evil from hurting others as a service, rather than attempting to go out and have recrimination and harm done back to the evil. Although I can't deny that for moments or more, it enters in my mind and in my senses, like I'd like to go over there and smash their car or do this or do that. But, you know, that's all wrong. And it destroys joy and bliss to entertain them. Because the correct passion is not to turn the other cheek, by the way, which I know that some Christian folks have that. That was a misunderstanding of that statement. Turning the other cheek is not to go and directly harm the others, but it is to harm their ability to do harm. It is their ability to harm their ability to do harm by intervening in ways that prevents them from further harming both you, if they're harming you, and the multitude of other people that they're going to eventually do this to besides just you. So that is the way evil needs to be dealt with. Now, I know that some people say, oh, but that's so removed. It'd be much nicer to go and do something directly. No. That doesn't work, because then all you're doing is making two mistakes, two wrongs, which will never turn into a right. The correct process is to prevent them from doing more evil to you and to others. And why prevent it from them doing it to you? Isn't that self-focused, you might say? No. Because if you are serving others and they're trying to prevent you from serving others, you have a right to stop that. Now, if you're being selfish and you're trying to prevent them from doing harm to you, yes, that's self-focused. But if, as long as you're focused out and you're serving others and they're trying to prevent you from doing that, then you can do whatever you need to do to stop them. You follow the difference, I hope. And it's also the difference that's so confusing these days about when to go to war, or when to fight others who are trying to destroy you, and how should you do that. Well, if you follow the principles I just said, it's clear as day. And if you don't understand those principles, it's muddy as night. And right now, most of it's muddy, because we don't understand the principles that I'm teaching, for the most part, today and many other times. And these principles need to be applied in your daily life, and not ignore it, because they give you the answers of how to respond. You see what I'm saying? Somebody flies an airplane into your building, what's the appropriate response? Well, if your focus is to serve others in having a building in the first place, and to build the economy and make it so that people have a means of both income and a way of dealing personally and their personality with creation, but that also can allow them as a stepping stone to be creative, more of God. You're doing all those things, and someone runs an airplane into your building, then you have a right to try to do everything you can from running any more airplanes in your building. Everything. If it's evil, you have the right to use force. You can't use force against how they think or feel. Can't use force against. You can't force them to think or feel something. But what you can use is you can force against the force in the physical world. So you can prevent it from ever flying any airplanes. And if you have to shoot them out of the sky or chop their head off, dump them in the ocean, incarcerate them, if you have to in some way torture them, you do it to prevent them from running their airplanes, well, your airplanes, into your buildings with them flying in them, or other things like that. I hope this makes sense to you, because it's a simple answer that is confused by people who think they're doing good when they're not. They're doing terrible things and they don't understand it, because they're applying a general principle that shows an ignorance of evil and an ignorance of God. If you can't understand evil, you really can't understand good. You have to be able to understand it and see the difference and know how appropriately to function. Now, you notice I said even torture, some torture. The torture has to be with the purpose of preventing the building from being hit, or another building from being hit, or a bomb from going off. And it has to have specificity in some respects to be reasonable. That it's within reason. You have a good reason for doing this. Not because, well, it's fun to torture them because they deserve it. Or maybe they have some knowledge that we'd like to know about. No. It needs to be specific enough so that you know what you're looking for. And they're willfully trying to obscure that information from you so they can carry out their evil deeds. Then torture is appropriate. And we know that must be true, and I can tell you how we know it's true. Because if somebody says, I've got an atomic weapon and I'm going to set it off in 30 minutes, but I'm not going to tell you anything about it, And under the rules of the Geneva Convention, you can't torture me because that would be a bad thing. What are you going to do? When the bomb goes off, 10 million people die. Are you going to torture the person? And do anything and everything within your power, including torture, to get the appropriate information. And you say, well, you're never going to get good information anyway. Well, I'll take the bad information if it's some information when I got 30 minutes and 10 million people's lives are at stake. Okay? And the torturing does not equivocate to evil. You have the right to use force against evil when it is either threatening to or is using force against you in the physical world. We're not trying to get the person to change to our viewpoint. We're not trying to get the person to become a believer in the light. We just want and need that information as soon as possible to get people away from the bomb, disarm the bomb, destroy the bomb, whatever it's going to take before 10 million people die. And most people understand it when you get it to that level. Some people still don't. Because they want to apply smaller levels of concepts and principles to circumstances in which evil is functioning in its glory to destroy huge amounts of life in God's good. Once you understand the principles that I'm saying, which are metaphysical principles, by the way, they're not my principles, they were made up millions of years ago, in dealing with evil. Okay, hopefully that's understood. Now let me change the circumstance around so that we can understand this more clearly. Let's say, and by the way, the experience is the same. If you get the information and you stop the bomb, you will have joy. And you won't have remorse or grief over having tortured the person to achieve that result. Now, let's talk about the reverse. Let's say that you have some detainees, and you want to find out in general if they haven't told you the complete truth, so you decide to start torturing. Not allowed. Why not? Because it's not reasonable. You don't know what you're looking for, and the outcome of what you're trying to achieve is so indefinite that although you can say, well, in general, they're evil people, so they must be trying to do something, until you know exactly what it is you're trying to do, torture would not be an appropriate thing. The good news is, the last president of the United States, George Bush, not my favorite president, but nonetheless, the last president of the United States knew that. He got it. He got it, and it gives me joy that he got it. And he only permitted three people to be tortured for specific things that they were looking for. And one of them was the location of how they're going to find Osama bin Laden. That was just one of the things. And it was only three people instead of 300, which he could have tortured. He had about over that number that he could have, and he didn't. So you see the judicious element to this and the critical nature and the specificity of who and under what circumstances you're going to do this. And you're only torturing a person until they're willing to talk to you in ways in which the information they give you has been proven already, initially, to be true. You don't torture people to give you information you're going to rely on initially that you have no answer to. You always ask them for the stuff you know about. What you know, hey, yeah, that's true. Now they're telling me the truth. They don't know whether you know or not. Then you can start relying somewhat on their information. Evil has to be dealt with this way. I know it's terrible, but if we don't fight evil in this world, it will destroy us. And evil uses force, and we have to use counterforceful measures, but in a very careful way, a very careful way. And torture is one of the areas that I have the most equivocation about in how it's used specifically and only in the ways I'm describing. And so far, at least the last time I found out about the torture that was done by Bush, it seemed appropriate. For those of you who disagree, you know, you have a right to call in the show or send me an email or whatever. We can talk about it. I'm not against that. I'm open enough to discuss it. I want you to know that I won't likely change my principles about it, but we can discuss whether it's appropriate in this situation or that situation, et cetera. I think it makes sense. Or you could just plain disagree with my principles and tell me to go take a flying leap, and that's all right, too. I mean, it may not change me, but it might make you feel better. Okay, so be careful, though, about feeling better, because that's a personal feeling better, not a feeling better in terms of joy. Joy comes from strange things, then. Sometimes we can be joyful about preventing evil from harming. There is a joy associated with that. Now, should the joy be that we killed someone, like Osama bin Laden this last week and others? Should we be joyful that they're dead? Well, only when the joy specifically stops them from doing evil actions. It did. I myself might have chosen a different course. It was just as easy to have captured him. Granted, there's some downsides to that in a political sense. Unless you're really smart, which I don't think our president is as smart, but the present one, and you tell everybody you killed him, you never show any pictures of it, or if you do, they're made up, and you actually take him, and then you start questioning him for 10 years until you get the information you want. And if there's a specific situation where you need information, this would probably only be good for the first year or two that you have them, about some operation or whatever, then you can torture them until you get the information. So you see, you really do have some advantages by keeping someone alive. I realize the disadvantages if you made it public that you did that. But the way the government works, most of the stuff that they do, we don't have any clue about anyway. They usually are used to lying to the public. Most of the time, it's a bad thing, by the way. Very bad. Times of war, I'm not so sure, because then you've got the issue of telling the enemy what you're doing. That usually isn't a good idea. Yeah. A little bit of timely news related to tonight's show. Okay. So, back to the more positive side, away from the evil issues. I hope we don't have to talk more about that tonight. And so, if we're going to live our life so we experience joy, and we know from the joy, therefore, we have a feedback, we can sense God's name. Now, what does this mean? I've got God's name in me. If I'm sensing the name of the Lord, God, in us, and I'm not just sensing it by hearing it, I'm not just sensing it by seeing it or smelling it or touching it or tasting it, it's from all of those and more in the senses. Then does that affect me in an astral sense and in a mental sense? Yes, it does. Let me go, because so far I've really made this more about the physical, because that's the easiest one to talk about, the hardest one, I think, to get people to change about. Okay, and now let's talk about the astral. When we experience God's name in our astral body, which should also be virtually simultaneous with anything we do in the physical body, the sense is one of elation. Well, elation is different than happiness. Elation is the sense of being more one with all. It's the opposite of loneliness, tediousness, boredom, and isolation. That's what I'm talking about. Elation. Elation is the sense of being so connected with others that we expand all of our senses astrally, all of our feelings, to now incorporate all those we can sense with. It's like a state I call it super empathy. It's like a state where you can sense their sense of God, because their sense of God is being sensed by them having the same sense of everyone else that they're experiencing, and you're experiencing them at the same time. Wow. That's what I call the super empathic sense. And this super empathic sense produces a different kind of joy than the etheric physical kinds of joy, which may also be taking and should be taking place near or at the same time. And this sense is what I call the metaphysical equivalent of we'll call it spiritual elation. So this is just elation, but it's spiritual elation. This elated state is the state in which all sense of disconnectivity, loneliness, boredom, tediousness, fatigue is gone. All of it's gone. That's the sense I'm talking about. Now, you can say, well, that's only happened to me a few times. That could be. Maybe it's never happened to you. If it is, I'm sorry for you. But if it's never happened, you can create it to happen in your life by following tonight's formula about time and in the word, the Lord's name, so you can sense this vibration through you in your astral body. That's what it is. It's an astral vibration that eliminates all sense of loneliness. And human beings continually have, as a nature to themselves, while they're physically alive, a sense of loneliness. It's because they lack the elative part that is more natural for people who live in the astral world itself, and especially those who live in the astral world at or above the fourth astral subworld. That's where elation becomes much more a standard part of life for those alive in the astral world. And what's missing for those who are living, using more singularly their astral senses in the fifth, sixth, and seventh subworlds. For those of you who understand the astral world well enough to know what I just said. So you really want to get, most people do, to the fourth subworld at a minimum after your death, because it's the first place that in a more natural state you can experience elation just by being there. And that's a pretty cool thing to have happen. We cannot experience it naturally while we're physically alive, even if our consciousness is commensurate with those who are living in the fourth astral subworld, because the illusion and the inertia of energy and sense that we live in here mollifies and kind of negatively impacts that astral sense. So it becomes a rarity here, even if our consciousness would be equivalent to someone living in the fourth astral subworld, making it more difficult to realize. Can we realize it here? Yes. But you have to go beyond usually the levels that people who are at, who live in the astral world, to achieve it. Because you're living here where it's dampened even worse. We so limitedly can sense our astral senses while we're physically alive. It's very difficult, and more difficult for men than women. So men have even a harder time sensing elation while they're physically alive in comparison to a woman, on an average, just because it's more difficult. And elation is a wonderful sense to have. Again, it isn't about you getting it for yourself. You get it because of your connection with others and super empathy with the others. And it's not something you can contrive or create for selfish purposes. If you try to create it selfishly, you'll never get there. So you won't experience what you're missing, because it won't be there. It'll just be gone. Okay, so that's the part that is so wonderful to us, is once we reach a state of relation in astral terms, we are actually co-creating with God, and our heart and crown chakra are now helping us to sense the super empathy, and we're really in business. So it's all about the heart and crown chakra. If you read chapter 7 in Life's Meaning, you know that that's how I explain it. I'm a little more technical in the book, but I don't explain it from tonight's standpoint as much because I didn't have the time, or I should say time. I didn't have the space. I had the time. Didn't have the space to be able to write everything I'm explaining in tonight's show, even in that chapter. So a lot of it's missing. Oh, some of the more technical things might be there about it, but the missing part is about the richness of the examples, which I think really makes anything more understandable. But to write them out makes the book 2, 3, 4, 10 times longer. And believe me, you don't want any book any longer than Life's Hidden Meaning. I mean, it's a 4-pound textbook already. You don't need it bigger. And so to make it practical, that we could print it, and sell it, and you could carry it. It's so heavy that you can't carry it. And you're not having multiple volumes, which is something we considered at one point, that in order to get the more practical side, we had to give up a lot of what even tonight's show is trying to talk about. Okay. And going back in time, almost 20 years ago, I don't think I was as good a teacher or a potential writer as I am today. So there are certain things that I think could be improved upon in the way the book was written, making it a little easier and possibly still not any longer, I'm not sure, by including still some examples, but maybe shortening something else. Who knows? Although it's pretty short, pretty succinct in the way it says things. For a lot of people, they just go, well, can you explain a little bit more? This is really, like, fast and hard and too quick for me to grasp until I read it 10 times. Okay. Everything's a trade-off in the physical world. We get to the mental world, we can do that. But right now, in the physical world, I don't know how to do it. Okay, it'll be some kind of super Kindle thing, maybe. Whatever. All right. So let's continue on. So once we die and go to the astral world, our life changes because of this elation issue. And our experience on a daily basis is a lot more joyful and has more chances to experience bliss for folks that are living usually from the fourth subworld up. Now, it's really the best place to experience both of these qualities, joy and bliss, is if you can live in the second and or first subworlds of the astral plane, where people are focusing their life on spiritual service. Those are the subplanes of service. And the people there are the most conscious, and there you have much more obviously the evidence of what I'm explaining and the model, with the direct experiences in that model of the whole process. Not too many people live there. It's nowhere near as large a world, subworld, as like the fourth or fifth or sixth subworlds, the astral world. But nonetheless, it is available for those people who choose to live a life of spiritual service. And people, therefore, in those realms that are living there, experience this elation and the subsequent joy and bliss that may come fairly consistently. Wow. They also live there a long time because of the time dilation issues, although they don't live as long as you might expect because they're doing service in lower realms sometimes. But nonetheless, they do live for very many, many hundreds of years, living in a heaven-like way because they're in a state of bliss, sometimes a state of joy even more often, and they're serving great deals of time. Some people don't serve all the time because they're still in some level of illusion. After all, they're living in the astral world. They're not living in what truly is heaven. But it's heaven-like, at least to people who first get there anyway. And so their experience of God's name, the vibration of God inside of themselves, is still somewhat transient. It comes and it goes, but it's very noticeable. If you can get to the second even astral subworld, this sensation of these vibrations of God and elation and joy is very noticeable. It's so noticeable, as a matter of fact, that the real suffering that these people go through is when they choose to go to lower realms to serve people there, and the people are very resistant to receiving service sometimes, and then they lose, the servers do, their sense of elation and joy that they experienced while they were in the second or first astral subworlds of service. But they do it anyway. They go there anyway, and part of their sacrifice is to give up some of those feelings to help others and serve others. You could say, well, doesn't that come back in the now when they see from the quantum field the possibilities that people are going to change? Yes, it does when the people respond. But more often than not, the people don't respond. And so you go to your experience in that now is not of a good outcome, but of a negative one, possibly because of your own inabilities to reach better levels of teaching and service to others, or possibly because the people you're dealing with are just so virtually insensitive and gone that you're giving it the try, you're really helping, but the odds are against you and they're going to likely fail. And yet you go try anyway in some circumstances. You don't want to waste your time where there's no chance or very, very limited when you could be helping others who are being more responsive. But sometimes it's really a coin flip and you really don't know, so you go with it and it just doesn't turn out. So that's just part of the process. I don't want you to think everything is a panacea just because you're living in the astral world. It's not. Okay, we're going to run out of time here. I want to talk some about this, the experiencing God's vibration and name. Again, this is going, in a physics sense, through strings. I don't want to harp on that, but it's affecting all of the astral and eventually mental atoms in your body. This truly is a physics issue. And energy truly is following thought and the whole business that I've talked about many, many times on this show. So those who go on to the monastic world, they even get closer to this whole process of joy and bliss. But they're not feeling a state of we'll call it elation, because their astral senses, while they may be fused in some circumstances with their mental, the astral body itself is gone. So they can only sense the fused aspect of their mental body, which is not quite the same thing. But so you call it elation, but it's like mental elation. But the other sense that they have of their creator is the sense, and this is really amazing, I've talked about this before, the sense of the ongoing creative future that they are a participant in. They live much more in the future in the mental world. And so they are getting a sense of, within the realm of probabilities only, and possibilities, they get a tremendous sense of the future, and there the elation, you can call it, is the optimism, the extreme optimism, of seeing a potential future for humanity in which they're co-creatively involved in for hundreds, thousands, possibly, of souls that are their counterparts who they may, in some cases, be in the future incarnating with. This is a wondrous experience. The feeling is different than astral. It's the feeling of both some level of omniscience as well as a sense of incredible joy coming and bliss coming from creation of future Earth, the planet we're on. It's reaching a level of being in a godly position in directing and helping to create, but still not destroying the choices of others, Earth, and at the same time, usually crippling and hoping to diminish and eventually destroy evil. Not by necessarily hurting it, but by converting it into good. This is an amazing experience, but difficult to talk about because it's so near superhuman in ability. Because when you're living in the mental world, you're actually closer to being a superhuman than a human. You're moving towards rejoining with your soul. That the experiences are very foreign to people who are physically alive. So it's a little hard for us to be, let's say, understanding of the things that I have explained. I'm going to continue now to the end of the show. So this is a difficult, difficult area for us to get. But the incredible joy is of, with hundreds of other people creating solutions to problems that you live through for lifetimes, and others have too, and are in the present time living while they're physically and astrally alive. And you have these solutions. It's just, and you can see them actually work out. And you can sense the results in the people as they're working out. So you're living the future lives that are still potential lives. Remember, this is a virtual reality of people, and you get to experience the joy of those future lives. And not in a small number, we're talking about thousands. And you're living through those lives as though they're your life. Tell me, that isn't a kick. That's amazing. That's really cool stuff. And even though I made the astral world sound pretty good if you're serving there, there's nothing like the mental world. The mental world is like just a whole way beyond what you can experience of God's name in the astral world. You literally, in the mental world, if you're functioning there as a server and as an awake conscious being there, I'm talking about the lower mental world right now, not the higher. The higher is where our soul is doing this, but even at an even higher level. And eventually we will rejoin our soul and do it there. If I have time, I'll mention a few things about that. But here is a situation in which we are going through the lifetime or lifetimes of future selves, ourselves, and the future selves of hundreds and even, depending on how good we're at it, thousands of people in a future Earth. And we're living through those lifetimes now, while we're there, assuming we were there right now. Just imagine, and we're correcting all the problems, we're making everything into this beautiful world, this beautiful place. Just imagine living through those lifetimes while in the mental world, what that would be like. Tell me that would be the most amazing thing to experience. And we mostly experience the examples of things in those lifetimes in the lower mental world. And those examples are wondrous examples. Too many to count. They're really fantastic. Just imagine all the examples of a perfected life if you were to have one while you were alive right now here in the physical world. Well, you get that, but for thousands of people. And you get that for people living in the astral world, but again, for thousands of people. And so this is just unbelievable, to be able to experience all the other people you're doing this with all together at the same time, sharing it together. Talk about kick your butt into super high gear metaphysics and spiritual life. This is it. Okay, how does that in an example way then give you a sense of God? Well, God is doing everything we're saying, but for a whole universe, not for one small planet and just a thousand people on it. So, I mean, God is doing this on a scale that's beyond our comprehension for sure. But we also get to experience some of God in the process. Because when you get up to 1,000 people, OK, okay, it isn't a God experience, but you get to experience a bit of God's reaction to it on a universal scale. Now, that's hard to understand that, too. The soul experiences that far more than we would in the lower mental world, but we're going to rejoin our soul, and we know that. So, okay, we were almost out of time, so let's jump into the soul here. The soul, then, is experiencing much more of God than the person is. So that when the person dies from the lower mental world, they give up that lower mental body, and the personality hopefully has fused with the soul if this is really an advanced person. We then join the soul who now is experiencing not just the other souls that are working with it, which is what we just talked about as people, now starts experiencing some of God's experiences that are common to those experiences that the souls are experiencing on this world, but common in all other realms. All other realms being like other planets, other galaxies. It's starting to become unfathomable how great this experience is. Talk about elation. I mean, it's like beyond all that we can ever experience, right? This is what the soul is experiencing part of. Now, is it the same as God? No, because the soul is still not even a liberated soul yet. But it's a piece of it. Let's say it's millions of people's lives experienced for millions of lifetimes in this place and other places. It's still a fraction, very, 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 very small fraction of all those alive. There's still millions. It's a huge number. And it's God's experience of these millions and beyond that we experience. We experience some parts of God that we can't exemplify because they're way beyond us. And we can't even formulate because they're beyond the mental world's ability to represent something through formulation. So the only way we can experience it is by having some ascendance to the God level, which the soul does have the ability to slightly have that experience. And even the slightest amount of that is so revealing, so incredibly rich, that it's beyond the words I can provide. And you're feeling the vibrations now of God's name through you, all the time you're a soul. Wow. So being a soul is far beyond anything I can describe in human terms, because it's another step. And we will be going back to being our soul, all of us, except those who are evil. The dummies, they give the most amazing thing up about being in existence. The evil ones. Because that's really the amazing part of being in existence, is to be going, we're all going back there. We're going back to our soul. That's the real heaven, if you want to call heaven anything. That's the amazing place to be. Now, some people say, but isn't that just for a few years in terms of our time here? And I say, well, yeah, but it's forever. Because when you start experiencing God directly in what it's experiencing, there is no time you can apply to. It's just an amazing experience. It rejuvenates us. It's our reward, if you want to call it, for helping God to build life in the lower worlds. And it's a tremendous, tremendous, valuable reward. Well, at this point, we are running out of time. And I do want you to realize that there's a lot more to talk about in terms of God's name and time. And hopefully this show has made some difference, even if it's small difference, because there's so much to explain about this and so much difficulty in relating it to our experiences in the here and now. Okay, hopefully this has been an interesting show to you all. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.